Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey everyone, welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Taravella, and today I'm excited to have a twofer with Nick Earls and Eric DiNicola. They're the co-founding manager principals of Winter Spring Capital. They have over a decade of experience between finance and development of multifamily condos. So welcome to the show, guys. How's it going today?
Pretty good. How about you?
Just living the dream. Yeah, absolutely. Just living the dream. Excited to talk about multifamily and investing. And I think with your group primarily developing in Boston, it's a very interesting, you know, the Northeast has not gotten a lot of love the last few years, especially in development has just taken off. So I'd love to kind of hear how you guys got started in developing in Boston, where it's, you know, it hasn't gotten a lot of love in the last 6, 8, 12 months of just everything going on. So I'd love to hear kind of how you guys got started.
Yeah, absolutely. So Eric and I are actually best friends for the past 20 years. Most of the principals and partners in our company. Oh, yeah, that was missing. Yeah, maybe those are a little too corporate, right? But yeah, that it's a long-term friendship. We met in high school and we decided from a young age, you know, we wanted to do something together, start a business in something. We didn't know what it would be. I've always kind of been real estate adjacent. My dad's a general contractor. So I discovered the real estate industry through him. When I was a kid though, I thought, all right, I'm never doing what my parents are going to do. They seem very stressed out all the time. Small business owners. That's often the case, working, you know, long hours and doing better than, you know, maybe some other people around, but there's a price they had to pay to get there. So it was kind of a struggle to get to the point where I was like, well, actually maybe real estate is for me and I don't have to be a contractor. I could be a broker, which is what I started with, as being an agent. And I sold kind of mid-sized apartment buildings for a few years, and Eric could kind of tell his story during that time period.
Yeah. So I was working in New York City after college. I went to school in New Jersey, so I'd moved down there. Nick and me are both from the Boston area. So I'd moved down there and I got into finance. And I worked in public equity and then private equity before, you know, about 6 years ago now. Nick said, all right, you know, I kind of have this plan. Let's make this happen. And, you know, he said, he'd been working for a few years already in the space, but he got me interested. My skill set in finance kind of helped because obviously real estate's a big numbers game. It was more interesting to me. I got my real estate license as soon as I, you know, moved back up here and started working with them. And that was kind of part of our plan. You know, we'd be licensed, we'd be able to sell our own units, and we could sort of, you know, vertically integrate as much of the process as we could when we started.
Yeah, so we kind of had a plan that I came up with and maybe around like 2011, 2012, around the time I got my real estate license, that we wanted to get into owning rental properties. And at that time I was kind of absorbing all the knowledge I could, reading Bigger Pockets, listening to lots of podcasts. And it turned out that we were both saving up money at the time. We didn't know you could raise money from investors, which we do now, obviously, but at the time we were noobs. So we thought we had to raise all the money ourselves. And so we were literally raising money for, I don't know, it was like saving our own money, and it was like 4 or 5 years. And it was just kind of this plan that we'd buy rental properties. And it turned out that we were coming out of the previous recession, you know, in 2011, 2012, when I came up with the plan, and the rental property seemed like really good idea at the time, but I didn't really have the money to do it. And I didn't really, I'm not a no money down guy. I wanted to have my own equity in the thing. And so it took me a couple of years.
Your finance partner would agree likewise, having that equity in the deal.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, he keeps it a tight ship around here. But Yeah, it turned out that in those years, Boston really took off, especially for condominium sales. So when most people think of multifamily development, they think that you're building an apartment building. We build condominium buildings. So it's kind of a hybrid model where we're building multifamily at the scale and we're getting, you know, large construction loans. We've got equity investors, but at the end we're selling to homeowners. So it's kind of in between, some similarities to what you'll see with, you know, if you're a flipper, a single family developer, and then most of it is more complex, but then at the end, during the marketing phase, you're selling to a homeowner. But Boston's been really good for condominium development. The population has just kind of exploded over the past 10 years in Boston specifically, not the state itself, but just the city. Like, a lot of people are moving from the suburbs into the city. And there's people coming from out of state as well. And just the nature of the city is one of the oldest cities in the country. The housing stock's very old, and to get a project, there's just not much land really left. Adding on top of that, a lot of red tape, a lot of bureaucracy. So there's just a huge pent up supply, demand rather, without the supply there. So it's a really good place to do condominium development. We kind of noticed that and kind of jumped on a project in 2015. And that's where we carved out a niche, is in condo development. And we eventually circled back to that original goal of building up our rental property portfolio, which we've been doing. And that kind of segued into raising money for larger multifamily, going into different markets throughout the country. But we're always doing condominium projects. We have over $40 million of projects in the pipeline that'll be coming up in the next year, awesome, starting construction.
That's amazing. And I think that's like a good piece when people talk about markets and knowing your markets like the back of your hand. It's important because, like, you could look at Massachusetts and be like, oh, it's declining population, but going that layer deeper and saying, well, they're all going to Boston, and then solving that problem of there's high barriers to entry. You're solving a niche because you're building something new when everything's old. So, you know, when you see these, you know, the newer investors, like, oh, I want to go where people are going, but you've really just went super micro and granular and solved a very big problem in a market that allows you to stick out, because, like you said, with older housing stock, the red tape, which I'm sure as a developer is fun to deal with, and the headaches of just like, what, why this, why now, and why. So it's just solving problems, and that's like the biggest thing that you can add value as a real estate investor that we do that not many people think about.
That's right. I mean, we'll see a piece of land or a single family house somewhere surrounded by, you know, multi-families, even if, say, they're only 2, 3, 4 family unit buildings, and we're looking at a single, we could envision, you know, we could put 10 condos on that piece of land with parking underneath. And we know per neighborhood of Boston, you know, you kind of spoke about maybe looking at the whole state. We had said about the population increase in Boston specifically. We know typically, you know, East Boston versus Jamaica Plain, Dorchester, these are kind of boroughs of Boston. So we know what we could get on a per square foot basis on the sellout. We know what it costs us to build it. So we can quickly kind of look at something and say, okay, yeah, it'll maybe be a long process going through the, you know, Board of Appeals, getting zoning relief, getting the variances we need to put 10 units in a 2-family zone. But we know, okay, this could really work. We should really put some effort into this because no one's seen this. Somehow people have passed over it. We know how to make it work. It's just a matter of going through that long entitlement process. Which, you know, there are firms out there, that's kind of all they do. They get land entitled and then they sell it permitted. So we've had some deals where, you know, we are involved with buying permitted land too, because we could still make money even with their costs for the permits. But that's a whole nother business model. And I can see why it's so valuable, of course, because there's so much red tape, as we've said a few times already today.
Yeah, it's really crazy how different it is from, you know, different areas of the country. But here in Boston, it's one of the hardest places to get things permitted. And due to that supply shortage while the population spiking, that barrier to entry, if you're able to scale it, you know, you get to the other side of the rainbow, you get a pot of gold. So there's a lot of headaches involved with it, as you said.
I hope you have that on your office to remind yourself every day, because I'm sure it's not.
Got
to. Doesn't feel like it.
No, it's we actually just this morning had a zoning approval for one of the projects we've been trying to get permitted for a year now. So that was good news. And it's, yeah, when you're in the middle of it, it really, there'll be moments when you think like, okay, I guess we got to give up. And we just don't give up. We just think, no, we can't give up. We've got, you know, this is our company, this is our life. This, we got investors, and we just keep pushing forward. And that's, I think that's kind of the thing that allows you to have success in a market like this, where there's so much bureaucracy and red tape, is that attitude. Because every single project, you're going to reach a moment where you think, oh, I got to give up. And like, if you don't have that other voice in your head saying, nope, you know, you're going to keep plowing forward, you will give up. And like, the people who keep plowing forward, they eventually like strike gold. It just keeps that persistence and that attitude of like, I'm going to make this happen, is really critical, especially in a place like this. There's other places where development, I hope for those developers in those markets, it's a little bit easier, but here in Boston, you gotta be pretty tough mentally to get things permitted.
Oh, I bet. I think the mentality of how, because as real estate investors, every deal, no matter if you've done single family to, it's always something. There's never the perfect close. We're like, all right, guys, good work. We turned in all of our documents. Like, even in our last deal, we got everything in, and every week I was like, are we good? Are we good? Are we good? And our lender was like trying to change the loan amount, but keep the same LTV because it's a portfolio. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Don't let this mess with. So like, no matter how prepared you are, something always happens. One initial, one doc. Like, so I couldn't even imagine on the development side of just dealing with the red tape of having to go through it time after time. But that's why you guys have a great partnership and are going through, and just that constant reminder of it takes years. And that's why I think when people see the Instagram, Facebook lives, and you know, I just closed this deal, and it's like, yeah, it looks really easy, but they don't show the hours and the 10 PM phone calls and all this other stuff that goes into it. And you're just like, what the hell?
And the attorney phone calls that you can calculate the cost based on minutes very quickly.
Yeah, which I'm sure are very cheap in Boston, especially when they're so niche and specialized and good at what they do.
Yeah, bargain bin prices for zoning attorneys here. No, it's and being a zoning attorney in Boston is knowing all the politicians, you know, like, they practice law. I'm not saying they're not attorneys, but it's a political game here. You know, yeah. It's how it works.
So when going through that red tape process, I guess what, not being in the Boston area, what are like the hurdles that kind of like you target a property, get it under contract, or do you get it under contract first and then kind of work through the process and have just like a longer due diligence? What's that kind of look like?
Well, to answer that question, you can sort of do both. We've done both, depending on the situation. If we know this property is great, our fallback plan, maybe the as of right zoning allows for even just a couple units, that the area is so hot and the price per square foot is so high, we think, all right, if we try to, you know, offer based on a contingency here that we don't pay for a year once we have a permit and we can go through due diligence, they're probably not going to go for it because someone else is just going to buy it in cash, or just, you know, buy it with 25% down, take ownership. So if that's the case, we will buy it outright and we'll hold it and pay holding cost as we go. But if there's a lot of risk associated with it, and say it's like a single family zone, and the backup plan, if we were to get our variances denied, was not strong, we would try to approach it with what we would call, you know, like a zoning contingency, where we'll go to the owner and we'll say, hey, look, you know, your property is worth this much. We're willing to give you this much more if you sign this contract. We'll put some money down now, but we're not going to close until we have a building permit. And some people are in no rush. They didn't plan to sell their house at all or their property, but they see this, you know, exorbitant sum and they say, okay, you know, I'm willing to do that. So we've done both, you know,
especially with a hot single family market. I'm sure that's like, okay, you're paying well above what I could even fathom. So I'm sure that helps.
Yeah. And it's good for off market deals where you're going direct to seller because they're not ready to move 3, 4, or 5 months from now. So that permitting can actually line up. If they're tossing around the idea in their head of someday selling their house, maybe actually having this long ramp up where we're getting time to get it permitted and they're getting time to leave their house and move somewhere else. It actually, the stars align and it's good for everyone. So we've had some deals like that where, you know, we talked to, we get a guy, another longtime friend of ours, who's specifically on this off-market prospecting, and he basically will hit the phones and knock on doors, send letters, all those sorts of things. But he's had deals that he's found for us where, you know, he's gone to these people. He said, just like Eric said, you know, on the market, your house is worth this much due to our ability that we think we can do this many units. You know, we'll pay you this much. And the people, obviously, as you said, they'll be, oh, wow, you can get even more than the market value. And then, you know, every once in a while, someone will say, yeah, I've been, you know, I'm thinking about selling my house someday. And that longer window while you're permitting actually helps you. And you can get some pretty good deals doing that.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. It's especially because it's, once again, it's finding out a problem. Like, oh, I'm kicking the can, but I'll give you a ton more money, and the time aspect. So you're just checking all the boxes of solving problems for the community. But where, I guess, in bot, like, how do you target a particular area? I know you guys talked about the end in mind of, like, price per square foot on the exit. So do you kind of just look at the entire map of Boston and say, okay, well, we can get that. We know how much we build, but is there just a particular pocket you look for based on that exit per square foot?
Yeah, since we're in the condominium game and we're selling to homeowners, a lot of data we get from MLS. We're on CoStar too, but we're looking at data being sold to condominium owners. So one of the places I like to go on MLS is, and I don't know if all MLSs offer this, but the one in Massachusetts does, is map search, where you can basically define parameters of a map and you can put in your minimum price per square foot. And then you'll look at all units that have been under agreement, contingent for a sale, or sold within the past 6 to 12 months, whatever time period you think is appropriate for the volume in that market. And so I'll look at, I know the cost of construction, I know the acquisition price in each neighborhood, so I know the minimum price per square foot I'd need to make a good project. And then I'll put that, or I'll go, you know, a decent delta above that even. And then I'll look and see what's going on in each market. At this point, we don't need to do that anymore because we kind of intuitively know where each market's going, and we kind of pick up, obviously there's shifts over time, but you kind of pick that up. But that's a good way to start, is to really, if you really dive deep into the details, you'll notice little things. Like, there's a bunch of different neighborhoods in Boston. One of the bigger ones, Dorchester, like it's a pretty big neighborhood, right? So there might be fluctuations of street by street differences. And when you look on, like, map search, for instance, we found something interesting in Dorchester, is there's a highway. And if you go beyond that highway, you're not selling condos there. And, like, yeah, you know, maybe you can drive through there and perceive that people say, like, drive the area, which I think is very important, but I like data. You know, I have literal data telling me, hey, this side of the highway, you can get luxury condos sold for $750 a square foot. This side, there's no sales of condos at all in the past 2 years.
I'm sure Eric appreciates this. It's just like, years of training all coming to fruition right now.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, to add to Nick's point, it's like, we're so familiar with the different, you know, the different areas of Boston, different neighborhoods, and then each one has their own sub neighborhood, that there's some areas, almost getting back to, you know, kind of your original question, not that we necessarily target these other ones as much as we'll say, okay, we're not even going to look there. Certain neighborhoods we know, condos just don't sell, or we know what the price per square foot is for them. And maybe it's not terrible and you could squeeze out a profit, but it's too close where we know there might be other opportunities, so we'll just stay away. And there are a few, you know, boroughs, if you will, of Boston that condos aren't really big yet, and maybe never will be, who knows, I don't want to say yet, but that we won't focus on.
Yeah, and I think that's important, just having that criteria on the front end, because, like, when it just reminds me of, like, when I did my first single family, I just pretty much took, like, recently sold and then the rents, and just looked for, like, the 1% rule to hit. I'm like, all right, perfect. That's it. So, and I think too, is when you guys have that years of experience, because I know talking to newer investors, Like, I just want to underwrite as quick as possible. I don't want to spend the time to go, but that's how you know the markets and the line items and everything in it. So you guys have enough years of experience where you can quickly look at it versus I think the, it's like inverse with new people. Like, I don't want to spend any time underwriting, but because you've been in it for so long and I've been in two, it'll be my second year this week in commercial real estate, underwriting 2 to 3 deals a day for that long. And now I'm like, oh, okay, this is what I can anticipate. And people are like, well, how do you know? It's like, when you're eating the numbers, you know, and being boots on ground and doing all these things, that's how you can really find the opportunities that not many others can see.
And I would say, you know, we have a similar situation to you where we're underwriting all these deals. And there's been times where we'll spend hours looking at something and then only to find out, oh, you know what? The broker, the owner was wrong. Actually, they did have another offer that they're going to accept and it's too late. It, you know, some situation like that, whatever it is. And we try to take away all of it as sort of as a learning experience, say, okay, well, at least we learned something. We practiced that and now it'll be faster next time. So that's how we try to look at everything. Cause there is a lot of what, you know, some on the outside might consider wasted time, but it does all go towards the end goal. Okay. You know, 99 out of 100 deals you underwrite are not what you want to see and you move on, but that's all part of the process and it speeds it up as you go down the line, you become more familiar with it. You can make assumptions much, you know, easier. You can really know what you're dealing with. And for when that right property does come, you know exactly how to look at it.
You got to put those repetitions in to like anything else. Like Eric and I, when we were younger, we used to compete in powerlifting. So like coming from a weightlifting background, it's like, you know, each repetition gets you closer to that goal. You go in the next day, you're a little bit stronger. Next week, a little bit stronger. 3 years later, you know, you've changed completely. So that sort of mindset is kind of, we're very used to that. We're long-term planners. And if you're getting into real estate, you got to think long-term. It's a long-term thing. So if you have the mindset of, I want to do everything today, you know, you're going to get frustrated and
you're going to get hurt tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say it's key. What Nick just said, that's key. Foresight and patience, I think, are a big component to the mental aspect of this game.
Oh yeah. Especially with like years, like last year, those years, it was like pretty much all rules were out and everyone became a economist, accountant, lawyer, and just trying to figure it out. And it was, I told our analyst, cause he like just onboarded a couple months prior and was like, listen, this is the one opportunity where you know as much as the person who's been doing it for 30 years. So just keep reading. And that's how you come out stronger as a better investor. Like no one could underwrite that, but being in the Southeast, no one would have thought we would have had 92 to 96% rents collected the whole year. But it just following those geographic trends, having that foresight to just look out and be like, hey, follow the jobs, follow the people, and good stuff will happen. And that's just continued. I saw a report today that like half the transactions last year on the acquisitions for multifamily were in the Southeast and Southwest where we are. So it's only going to get hotter. And the more you own, the better. You know, like you said, the more at bats you'll have. And even once you close, there's that momentum of continuing to get more deals like you guys and continue to grow and expand.
It's like a snowball effect.
Absolutely. A lot of snow in Boston too. But
not today. We're really hot right now.
Knock on wood.
We shut off the air conditioner to talk to you here so it didn't overpower the sound. And we are sweating.
Well, to kind of transition from the development, I would love to hear kind of more of how winter spring came about because it's that development piece. But, you know, you mentioned winter spring capital and the investing side. So I think with that background, how did winter spring become what it is today?
So we started raising money for our development, our condo projects a couple of years ago now, I think it was like 2018, maybe we started. And at the time we had just heard, you know, people are raising money for these condominium projects. And it kind of just opened us to this whole world of, you know, capital raising for real estate. And it kind of shifted our mindset because we had been, you know, doing these small purchasing these smaller multifamilies in this in Massachusetts and kind of building up our own portfolio here. Like I said, that was kind of our goal all along. And that was all our own money. It was the profits we'd made from the development jobs. And we started raising money for the development jobs. And we started thinking, hey, people really like, you know, investing in real estate. And we started doing more research. And I had heard of syndications for a while at that point, but it was still new to me. We got connected with a good attorney who really kind of explained how it all worked. And
I love that already. I love that part of the story.
Yeah, that's got to be the first step, right? You gotta get the legal all in order.
Well, with Facebook, but, you never see that anymore. Everyone just posting deals online.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Wild West out there, but we're kind of reserved people. We like to do things by the book. So talk to the attorney, learned, you know, listen to podcasts about syndication, join some capital raising masterminds, networking groups. And at this point now we're kind of purchasing in a couple different markets. Eric can kind of talk about that because he's the boots on the ground with the underwriting. We're targeting a couple different markets in the Southeast, and we're looking bigger multifamily stuff, basically leveraging our development knowledge. Whereas a lot of, you know, syndicators out there that are raising money, they're people who were good networkers, they're good people, persons, or, you know, however you'd want to put it. They come from an investing, raising money background. We come from a construction development background. So we kind of stumbled into this raising thing. But I think that almost gives us an advantage in a certain sense, where a person who's really good at networking might be able to raise the money to buy a value add deal, but a developer has built a building like that. So, you know, we see a lot of opportunity, and we're going to be doing development too all the while, but just the market dynamics, it makes sense to buy existing properties, fix them up. Obviously, you know, that that's your own business as well. So that's just kind of, instead of buying these, you know, 6 to 8 unit smaller multifamilies that we've been doing up here in Massachusetts, we just want to, you know, go to those markets where there's the highest population growth, all the best demographic information, income growth. We can look at all that data just like we do with the condos. And we've selected some markets there, which Eric could talk about.
Yeah. I mean, everything we're looking at right now is pretty much in the Southeast, the Carolinas, looking at both states, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, Alabama. And there's certain submarkets in there, different MSAs that have very strong metrics. And like Nick mentioned, you even mentioned this earlier, Mike, is the kind of population growth. That's obviously a big thing. You need drivers behind, you know, your thesis and why you want to invest somewhere. We're noticing, and it, you said half of the transactions sort of in that area of the country. That's not surprising at all, because as we go through deals, talking to brokers every day, meeting new brokers, planning trips down there to different sites and everything, going out, you know, planning dinners and everything with the brokers, really getting to know these guys so that we're at the top of the list, because there are so many investors looking to buy down there. Prices are getting very high. Cap rates are getting compressed. You know, we'll talk to guys in Florida and they'll say, oh, you know, you, another one of you New York and Boston guys coming down here. And so we think that, you know, it doesn't scare us at all. We think we do have an advantage based on what Nick just said of our background versus some of these other guys. But then we also have the knowledge they have too from an investment standpoint. So it's really, I think we have a good makeup to make this work. And, you know, some of the deals we're looking at, you know, from a syndication perspective, 100 to 300 units will come in, you know, we'll raise investment capital from investors. We'll go in, we'll see where the value needs to be added. And that's kind of our whole play here, is essentially increase the rents, maybe refinance 5 years down the line and hold on to it. Keep paying investors distributions. They have a piece in real estate. They get to benefit from, you know, all the benefits of real estate, taxes, et cetera. And so we think, okay, we go into this property. Maybe there's a, right now it's generating $1,000 a month per unit in rent. We see that we can do this, 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 and this. Oh, and it's already below the market rent, which is about $1,200 in that area. So here's our plan. It might take 2 to 3 years to implement, but by year 3 or 4, this is really what we'll be at. And the value of that building has, you know, or many buildings, if it's a big complex, a garden style property, which a lot of the ones we look at are, the value of that property will be substantially more. So upon refinance, maybe we can pay all the investors back completely. And then everyone's in it at sort of an infinite return. If we can't, we still can pay them a big chunk. Their basis is a lot less, and we're all making really nice returns as the years go on. And we still own the property because we were able to add that value, which to us, especially if it's renovations, maintenance, that type of thing, even more so than managerial value, it's very familiar to us because of the development background.
Well, and plus two, it's the development background, and you're with that. I think that adds a huge piece because I think a lot of people are targeting similar size units. And I, once you said about being another New York, Northeast Boston guy trying to invest in Southeast, reminded me of earlier in the podcast, we're like, well, we're just going to keep showing up, and how do we get it? And just keep going and going. Like I had this similar instance with brokers of, I'm like, hey, it's Mike. Do you have any deals? Like, I'm coming to Huntsville. Do you want to meet? And they're like, we'll let you know when there's a deal. I'm like, perfect. I'll call you in 3 weeks. Click. And then just like every 3 weeks getting out, because you got to be top of mind. And not being in the market, it's tough. But as long as you're consistent and looking and responding, that's like the biggest piece. But I think that development background is so huge because there's a lot of 60s and older products out there that trade that newer investors are like, oh, the plumbing's fine. But once you see galvanized pipes, you're like, uh-oh, it's going to be a bad time. And so, and people don't see that, but you're like, oh, just another day, check up. Just going through it. And you won't win every deal, but when you get that good deal, it'll allow you to do a lot more to it, that that heavier lift that you guys can really execute on. And that's probably where the values have been driving the most from, is doing those crazy projects, but you guys have a ton of experience with it.
And we're even seeing, Mike, the value or some of the prices that they want. You know, they'll offer guidance to brokers on where they think something will trade at, and some of these prices are almost assuming 2 or 3 years of value add has already been put into it. So it's creating even more competition out there. We're seeing a lot of bridge loans, a very high percentage, just because, you know, it's sort of a more traditional or agency loan, it won't work for it because the numbers just don't line up as is. So that's another sort of barrier, but we're getting through it, and we have strategies to get around that. And that is what the marketplace is presenting right now. So we just another thing to kind of keep barreling forward, as you said.
Yeah, especially with P&I reserves going away. I'm sure that helps, but then there's going to be the after effect of what happens to interest rates and all that other stuff. So it's one big crystal ball, but as long as you're going in the right direction of the path of progress, which I think we all can agree, if people are coming down here in the Southeast and just being in those appreciation states, because I've seen other investors get carried by the appreciation and cover their weakness. But I think with your guys' background, it'll do phenomenal. It's a matter of when, not if. And if you guys are ever in Tennessee, let me know. We'll happily set up dinner or whatever. If you guys have questions on Tennessee markets, happy to help.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
We will be. We'll do that then.
One question I had of looking in those development pieces and being, obviously, I think the memes about wood being expensive and everything else, how do you monitor your, like, how do you price out construction budgets? Because look, everything I've tried to learn on development without having the experience is like, you don't know. And it's impossible to kind of price it out. But how do you guys, looking in so many different, like obviously developing Boston, but how do you kind of figure out the price in, on developments when it, that cost of construction piece?
So, I mean, when we started, it was guesswork at the very beginning. We were complete newbies. We were kind of asking around other contractors. And then over time we built up from experience what we've paid on jobs. And that has kind of been our method for a couple of years. We had like kind of a database of every invoice, and we kind of tracked really in detail project costs for every project we've done. But in the past couple of years, we started working with general contractors. So we could kind of shift more towards strictly being on the development side and not being into the construction too much. Because
there's speed of the game of that. Because if you're doing in one project, you're not looking up at the next one.
Exactly. It's like if you're wearing too many hats, one of the hats going to fall off. And construction is such a time-consuming and like all-encompassing thing. Like it's so. I see some developers who like they've got good projects, but they'll be posting Instagram. You know, they're at the job site all day. Well, I mean, if you're at the job site all day and your guys are working, what are you doing? Like you got to find your next project. And you gotta, so it's like being a developer is honestly a very different role from being a contractor, a construction person. And it took me, you know, my dad was a GC, so it took me a couple of years to really like get that, which might be obvious to some other people, but once you really separate those two tasks, it's a lot easier. So we have a couple different GCs we work with, but we have a really good firm that we're working on. We have an upcoming project in Brighton, which is near Harvard and MIT. It's a 32 unit that we're pretty excited about. But we've got this GC that we've been working with for a couple of years now. And we'll get quotes for every line item well in advance of even considering like funding a deal or closing on a deal or any of those sort of things, especially in a project like this where we're getting it pre-permitted. We can do all of our due diligence. When you're getting it entitled yourself, you got to kind of have the vision, the creative vision of what's going to happen. And there is some sort of volatility and risk there. But when you're buying a pre-permitted, you can literally get your GC to get contracts months ahead of time with their subcontractors, which we do. And sometimes actually lenders will require that, especially in a environment like we have right now. Like as you said, the memes about lumber and everything's going up. Like it seems, I think we're gonna start going down now. If you're looking deeply at the data, but yeah, right. But in this environment where it's a little more volatile, lenders might actually require that you have all that squared away ahead of time. So that it's one of the things where building a team, especially in development, of where everyone stays in their lane and everyone's an expert at what they're doing. That's how you're going to reach those higher pinnacles. If you're trying to do everything yourself, and our method worked of tracking our costs, but that's super time consuming. And it's a different task that takes you away from finding the next deal, from finding the next investor, from underwriting deals, speaking with brokers. So that's kind of, we rely on the experts, I guess would be the short answer to that question.
Yeah. I think it's important. I mean, it's okay to do those foundational of here's how much it costs, because then you don't have to like backtrack and recalculate and recalibrate. Like you don't have to worry about that foundational piece, and you can just add pieces to it with the investors, the returns, and then you're paying them. It's just like that cost piece is such a fundamental aspect that investors need to know and get right, because the last thing you want to do is five different deals and they're all losing money and then it's just like dead in the water from the beginning. So I think that's just a great foundational piece.
And we thought from the beginning, even when we didn't know anything, we knew, hey, if you go overboard on being conservative, you know, you're going to come out on top in the end, because you under promise and over deliver rather than the opposite. So we kind of from the beginning, we had an idea, hey, construction cost per square foot, it's around $225 right now. We're going to budget at 250. Yeah. And sometimes that'll make you turn away a project where you could have made money, but we don't want to deal with that small of a margin.
Yeah. And that's a great point of building in that margin of error and understanding where you can pull those levers. And when you're first starting off, you're just like, yeah, if you're conservative across the board, you'll say no to a lot, but you'll know you get those base hits and singles, which can turn into those triples and home runs. So it's a great piece. But yeah, as we're kind of, I appreciate you guys hopping on the podcast, but before we kind of get into the end, we'd love to kind of hear both of your investor pro tip to our listeners out there.
Yeah, my one would be always keep learning. If you're getting into this and you think you've mastered it, you know, you're probably wrong. There's always a higher
pinnacle. You're getting punched in the face tomorrow.
Exactly. So, and I've had moments like that where it's like, wow, I figured out the system. And then some new thing comes at you. But always being prepared, first of all, by like getting all that data and always keep learning, but also keep learning new methods. Don't Don't say, oh, I found a lane. Like, maybe you can add different methods to what you're doing. Or like, for instance, in our story, we started off, we didn't know anything. And I came from kind of a construction background, and we just kind of leveraged that and just jumped into it. And then gradually we kept learning new methods. We learned about raising money. We learned about syndicating deals. We learned about, you know, doing larger ground up projects. When we started, we didn't know how to get land entitled. So like our ascension, our growth curve has been driven by learning, and no one's going to come and tell you things. You can seek out mentors, which is super helpful. But for me, it's mostly been looking at watching, observing what other people are doing at a distance that are a couple steps ahead of me, and just keep continually educating yourself, take courses, listen to podcasts, listen to audio books, read books, just anything you can do to increase your knowledge on real estate and investing in general.
Well, I have to say something different, but I agree with all that. So I would say just kind of resiliency, patience, and foresight are very important in this industry. I think I already mentioned it earlier, but if you don't have the right mindset about how sort of much of a long game real estate is, it's going to be a tough go. And even on a sort of a small scale thing where you're dealing with an individual project, you get into it and you think, okay, we can do this and this. But before, you know, you even have a shovel in the ground, you might have already dealt with 18 months of this thing, and then you have to build it, and then you have to sell the units. So if you have the right mindset going in to be patient and understand that if you take the right steps now, everything will fall into place. Just keep taking the right steps as you go along. When you're older, you're never going to regret that you did this. It may take a little while to get where you want to be. There's delayed gratification involved. But as you really see it start to come to fruition, if you were patient, that allows you to get through it easier. You're not going to get frustrated as you go. You understand this is a multi-year game. And like I said, even a single project that you're not going to hold might take multiple years. So
and an approval. Patience.
Yes, an approval itself. That's why it's like we mentioned that the firms that'll just do entitlement, because that's so valuable. And some people just don't want to go through that process. We don't like it. We go through it, but it's not fun. So patience, you know, resiliency, get back up, and really just have foresight and say, look, I know where this will lead me. You just to kind of piggyback what Nick said, you look at what other guys have done, and everyone knows someone who, you know, is older, owns real estate, and they almost kind of lucked into it. Maybe they bought it, you know, 35 years ago. You can do that too. When you're older, you know, if you made all the right moves when you were young and you started off the right way, you're going to be very happy with what you did. So really, again, patience, I'd say, and really believe in it and buy into it. And if you do the right things, it'll pay off.
Yeah. Nick's advice reminds me of Scott Adams of every time you add a skill set, your odds of a success go up 50%. So, you know, development, then fundraising, then investing, like all those different skill sets have made you successful. And then Eric, I just love it takes 10 years to be an overnight success. So it's one of those long things that I think we've all seen those closings of, man, these guys are closing deals and these guys are closing deals. But you just know as long as you're learning every day, growing every day, you will get to that point. And it takes a long time, especially in that social media now mentality. But like you said, you look at it 30 years from now and you're like, oh man, like look at the last 10 years. I'm like, my biggest regret was not buying everything, because 5 years from now, it's like, oh, I would have never guessed here we are. So you're building those blocks of foundational wealth creation. And then everyone has their own journey, and as long as you stick with it, good things will happen. So I appreciate sage advice, and appreciate you guys having on. If people wanted to get to know you guys more, or Boston Development, or just wanted to just celebrate your win today, how can they reach out and connect with you?
So you can reach out to us by email, nick@winterspringcapital.com and Eric at winterspringcapital.com. You can also check out our website, winterspringcapital.com. We've got a bunch of articles, ebooks on investing, development, mostly a focus on multifamily, but we touch on the other asset classes as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for being on the show. Tons of advice that I truly appreciate, and great to connect. If you have any questions for myself, please reach out to me at MikeT@RanCRE.com. And until then, we will see you next week.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Absolutely. Thank you.